Museums today need a lot of money to pay for exhibitions, building upkeep, salaries. Some museums receive government funding. Others raise money by charging admission and selling posters, coffee mugs, mouse pads, and books in their museum shops. They also seek grants from private and corporate donors. But negotiating with donors can be difficult when their ideas about how their money should be spent clash with what curators think it's their mission to show. And donors, corporate and private, want to know that the results of their generosity are being seen. So museums are trying new ways to attract visitors. Sort of. While museums have changed, Alex Van Os reports that in some ways what they do and what visitors want has not changed all that much.
In Amsterdam, there's an old house near a street still paved with bricks. The house belonged to Rembrandt. Inside, behind the painter's studio, is a room full of weapons, seashells, stuffed birds, and Roman statues. All were props that Rembrandt collected and used in his paintings. This room full of stuff was reassembled recently, and it shows basically how museums started a couple of centuries ago. They were personal, idiosyncratic collections. Historian Stephen Asma has chronicled the evolution of museums in a book called Stuffed Animals and Pickled Heads.
The earliest museums really were just, for lack of a better term, they were kind of freak shows in which the bizarre was collected together with sober specimens in no real order or organization. But there wasn't really the scientific agenda that curators have today.
At first, museums were far from scholarly. That changed as soon as visitors started coming. Then museums collected and arranged objects based on research and a touch of showmanship. They wanted to tell a story and deliver a message, something patriotic maybe, or inspirational. Stephen Asma says that in the America of the 1800s, museums wanted to uplift the masses and teach them about progress and evolution and dinosaurs. To do that, museums then, as now, used a mix of information and sensation in their displays. In Paris, for example, at the 19th century Cuvier Gallery of Comparative Anatomy, visitors are still greeted by a most extraordinary depiction of nature red in tooth and claw.
There is a sculpture of orangutan with its arms choking this poor savage's neck, and it's really dramatic and wonderfully rendered, and it's kind of horrifying in its own way. You know, you're learning scientific information. But at the other hand, there's a kind of drama at the heart of it.
Now, apes don't really go around choking people, but at least it got visitors through the door. Nowadays, it takes a bit more technology.
Others estimated the sizes of the Earth and the Moon, and the distances between them, and reasoned that both were spheres.
After decades of presenting the fruits of their research behind glass cases and in dioramas, museums now have to lure modern audiences, weaned on TV and video games. By and large, this approach has worked. The Smithsonian last year got almost 30 million visitors. And across the nation, 6 out of 10 Americans visited at least one museum in the last year. That's according to a poll by the American Association of Museums. The poll also discovered that Americans trust museums, trust them a lot more than books, and way more than they trust the news media. Edward Abel of the Museum Association says that there's a key reason.
There's the perception by the public that we are dealing in fact. Now, that is frankly not always the case. They are facts as we know them today. But as museums continue their research and investigation over the years, information, new information becomes available, particularly in history, in science, and in art.
People have kind of belief that objects don't lie.
Stephen Weil is a museum historian at the Smithsonian.
I mean, words, newspapers are about words, essentially. And we all know that people can make up words and put down any words they want. It's hard to make up a seashell.
Presenting that shell to the public today may involve millions of dollars, especially if exhibiting it involves interactive computer displays and maybe an IMAX movie.
It's a story often told, and like all good stories, there's always something new to be learned.
With so much money invested, Weil says the operative word now for museum staff and funders is outcome. Who's coming to the show? How many? And what's the after effect? Gone are the days, says Weil, when museums could just have faith that they were doing a good job.
More and more funders are saying, we'd like something better than that. We'd like you know, if you can't quantify it, can you at least put it in anecdotal terms? Can you at least show us some focus group results? Can you show us something that indicates that you are doing this more than just for your own entertainment and that something is really happening to people as a result?
Museums have struggled to prove that in the face of criticism that they'd become temples to dead artists and ancient history. Now museums are trying to reach out. They're sending exhibits on tour, they're affiliating with smaller museums, and they're going virtual with their own websites. Finally, museums are moving away from exhibits based on the past to present-oriented programs with a community focus. In Seattle, in a former yellow cab garage, is the Wing Luke Asia Museum. It's an example of what curators call the ethnic-specific museum, featuring local musicians or performers and artifacts from the neighborhood. Ron Chu is director of the Wing Luke Museum.
The reason why our museum, which is very, very tiny in comparison to most museums around the country, the reason why we have relevance and why we have an audience is that people are looking for something beyond sort of the presentations that are provided by some of the larger metropolitan museums. People are looking for some connect to their life.
Ron Chu wants his museum to be responsive to the public. Chu used to be a journalist. Now he's a proponent of a new museum approach that gathers information and puts it out there quickly, just like a news program, and far different from how museums usually work.
You spend 3 years, you know, from start to finish, actually putting together an exhibit. And in this very fast-paced society that we now live in, 3 years is a long, long time to, you know, between beginning and execution, and the public may have moved on to another place. And so it'd be great if we could somehow envision ways to speed up that process, and then again in that process to have our feelers out to sort of figure out what it is that the community actually is interested in.
Even with a focus on speed and audience outreach, it's possible that simpler still works. Historian Stephen Asma recalls what happened at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago a few years ago. An exhibition there featured high-tech dinosaur robots that moved their heads and screeched. Asma says that, to the curator's surprise, there were days when people didn't pay much attention to these dinobots and robotosaurs.
Instead of people gathered around that, they were sort of over in this other part of the exhibit, gathered around a small plexiglass exhibit in which some of the paleontology tools were displayed along with smaller fossils, and really intrigued by it, and it was magic for them.
Perhaps in this era of museum change, it remains true that the right object, be it a fossil or a room full of curios in the old Dutch house where Rembrandt lived, the right object working on the right mind at the right time can trump robotosaurs and dinobots any day. For NPR News, this is Alex Vanoss in Washington.